This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell.
Now, why do we have data on that, Mueller? Why do you say, I love hearing it, but do we know that for a fact?
Everybody I talk to says that.
You're right.
You are their favorite zoologist.
Well, okay, we'll go with that then.
Okay. And by the way, if you need help bringing out the best in your pet, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls today, we have another special topic to share, Patricia.
That's right. You know, not a lot of us have dinosaurs for pets, admittedly, but we have been fascinated by dinosaurs, especially our kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
For years. And what makes it especially exciting is even today we keep finding new species of dinosaurs. So we're going to talk about a new species that was just found in Canada, and we're also going to talk about what do the fossils tell us about their behavior and their biology. Sort of a fun detective
work. Yeah, can they speak those fossils?
Or they can talk to us.
They can talk to us in more ways than one, I guess.
That's right.
Okay. And speaking of talking, we'll also talk to an author and biology professor about the natural history of families. You know, he says in the animal world, parents pick favorites and sibling rivalries can be deadly in some species. A really interesting topic. We'll find out more about that later on. But first, we have some callers waiting to talk to us. So let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Dana from Bethesda, Maryland, and I have a question about cats.
All right, go right ahead, Dana.
Well, you said that perhaps we can bring out the best behavior in cats. And I'm talking about three cats, one that I own that's 12 years old, that is a Persian, that acts very, very well. It can touch me without extending its claws, and it's very, very soft. And we call that behavior soft paws. And I was able to teach that to my parents, one of my parents' cats. We have two cats, and my parents are 82 and 83. They got sister cats, and the older cat knows how to do soft paws really well, but the younger cat runs around with its claws out all the time and scratches everything.
Mm.
Basically, she's kind of a wild cat. We don't want to dampen her wonderful personality,
yeah.
But we don't want to be scratched on the legs all the time either.
Well, there are a couple of things you can do both sort of logistically and a couple of things you can do behaviorally. One is just logistically. Let's just go over that. There's actually, rather than declawing your cat, which is, of course, an option that some people take, and the standard old-fashioned surgery is, it's a very radical surgery. I mean, you're basically taking off the last joint of each of their digits. But there are a couple of things that people do now. There's actually a little plastic ball that your veterinarian can glue. You clip the nails and then you glue this little ball onto the end of the nails, and it's I think it's called soft paws, actually. So you could trademark that and try and get in on the action on all the sales.
That's not a bad idea.
Commission or something. Actually, there are quite a few people who tried that. They don't last forever. I mean, that's the obvious problem, is probably the best thing to do would be to have your vet teach you how to do it if you want to go that route. You can even, and this is a bit of a stretch, but if you really enjoy training, you can actually train a cat to sheath its claws on cue. Now, this is not the easiest thing in the world to do. I have to tell you, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. But if you're really into it, I'd probably use a clicker. I'd probably use clicker training for that. That's one possibility.
How in the world do you do that?
Here's the short version.
Yeah, the short version is first you teach the basics of clicker training, which is click and then a treat, click, treat, click, treat. You get a little handheld clicker, and you teach the animal that if it hears the click, it just did something that's going to lead to a treat.
Okay.
So that part's really easy. And then the tricky part is to anticipate when those claws are going to come out. So you watch.
Oh, I have no problem with this cat.
This cat
always has its claws out.
You've
got the other ones to retract their claws.
Well, in this case, actually, what I probably do is predict when those claws are going to go in, and every time they do, then you click and treat.
Okay.
And then you put it on cue. You know, you could say something like, you know, holster your weapon or something like that. So that's one possibility. The other thing to do is to give a behavioral consequence. So whenever the cat uses her claws on you, I would try a shriek and then just stand up instantly. So if you're sitting down and the cat leaps up on you and there's a little claw action, you just stand up. You yelp like you've been brutally injured, and you just stand up, and the cat sort of tumbles off of your lap. Now, hopefully the cat doesn't use its claws to hang on to you as you stand up. That would be a very bad idea. But the other thing you can do is teach, is get this cat, and you may be doing some of this already, but I would increase the amount of play, appropriate use of the claws. So get lots of fishing pole toys. Give the cat lots and lots and lots of exercise where she can use her claws appropriately.
And good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call for you to join in. Patricia, we received an email question from, who's it from? Pat in Chesapeake, Virginia, and she writes the following. We have a new puppy. This is great. We have a new puppy who is doing fairly well in the potty training department. However, since he's smart, he's figured out how to meter out just a teaspoon of urine to earn a treat. Then he'll meter out another one and wait for another treat. How do I get him to drain all at one time?
That's a great question. That's a great question. You can just see this smart little puppy going, it's like, oh, I got this. Well, you know, you get to say what gets the reinforcement. That's the trick is, and I actually had a dog who did some, who actually does sometimes something similar. And so basically, since this dog has already learned, if I urinate just a little bit, I'll get a treat. You just need to up the ante. You just basically need to say, well, you know, you don't get reinforced for that anymore. So your dog's going to urinate and come to you for a treat, and you're just going to look up, away. No, wow. I'm sorry. And just wait. And given how smart this dog is, what well might happen is the dog is going to go do it again. Then it gets a treat.
Ah.
So you're just going to up the ante. And basically what your actions are going to say is, no, you don't. That doesn't get you a treat anymore. That got you a treat earlier, but it's not good enough now. It's like a sport. You know, you don't get reinforced by your coach for doing what you did when you first started learning. You know, 3 years before, right? Look, she picked up the tennis ball. Good girl. You know, you have to be able to hit it over the net, you know, and then you have to get better and better at it. So that's what I want you to do. Just up the ante and be patient, because your dog's going to get a little frustrated and confused at first. But just hang in there. Have faith. They're much smarter than we generally give them credit. Obviously, this dog's very smart.
Very smart dog.
So just you decide the criteria and be consistent.
And I can imagine all the fun she's going to have with this little guy as he grows
older.
Oh, even smarter.
Calls to mind my favorite saying when people say, my dog is so smart, and I say, I'm so sorry.
Yep. How do people email us with a question, by the way?
Well, it's easy. They just send us an email to pets@wpr.org. What could be easier than that?
And, well, maybe calling at 1-800-462-7413. That works, too. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Rush in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Hi, Rush. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for receiving the call. I've got a problem with my two German Shorthair Pointer females. One is about 3 years old. The other's a little older, about 8 months older. And the younger dog, over the last year and a half, has started challenging the older dog.
Uh-oh.
And on about, it's happened half a dozen, maybe eight times. And on two different occasions, it has escalated into really serious dog fights.
Oh, dear.
These are not only hunting dogs, but they're house pets, very, very loved pets. And we've been successful in interrupting the behavior,
okay,
but we haven't been able to get rid of it or control it.
Gotcha. One question for you. Are these females spayed?
The younger dog is spayed. The older dog is not.
Okay.
And we just had her bred, and after she has this litter, we are going to have her spayed.
Good. That will help at least to some extent. It's not. I don't want to make it sound as if it's a miracle cure.
Not a cure-all.
Because it's not. So probably the most important thing I do after spaying the older dog is to first get some phenomenal obedience on both of them, but particularly the younger dog if she's the aggressor, such that you can stop her in space from doing anything. And you can do that in real positive ways.
Okay.
So I would teach a woe, for example, or a no. I like woe just because it's no is so easy to get mad when you're saying it. No! No, no. But woe just has a sort of a bitter connotation to it. So basically, you're outside with her. She goes to, she's not far away from you. You have something great in your hand or your pocket. She goes to, I don't know, sniff anything, and you say, whoa! And anything, any response from her, her ear comes back towards you. Her head turns back towards you. You say, good girl, and you give her this piece of food. And she's like, huh.
Good.
Good. This is good. I like this. So you basically teach her to stop whatever she's doing when you say, whoa. And you obviously you gradually work your way up to sort of bigger and bigger distractions. I also like to teach, particularly for dog-dog aggression issues, a get back or get off. I have a young adolescent border collie who's just getting a little big for his britches and just gave a little challenge to my 13-year-old lassie about a week ago. And when he did, I got in between them. I faced directly towards him, looked right at him, and I said, you get off. You get back or whatever you want to say. And literally sort of body blocked him backwards. It's like you lose ground when you do that. And then I had him lie down and stay, and I had a little discussion with him, and I don't know if it helps, but it's very satisfying. So he's backed off and he's on a down stay, and I said, what do you think you're doing? And I was a little talking. I was very not very happy about it. And he was like, what? What did I do? So I don't know how sensitive your pointers are. Some are very sensitive, and some are not in terms of you being somewhat distressed. So you're going to get some great, great off-leash obedience on your younger dog. So you can tell her to stop doing what she's doing. You can back her off when she's, you know, whatever she's doing. She learns that she doesn't get what she wants by pushing her weight around. And if she has a minor challenge to the other, to the older dog, you're gonna stop it instantly. You get in between the two dogs, you face the younger one, you back her off in space. Now, is that going to be enough? I don't know. If it's not, I would contact someone who knows how to work on this without getting using a lot of physical punishment, because sometimes that just teaches them you get what you want by fighting.
Mm-hmm. So a certified applied animal behaviorist?
Would be a great idea. Yeah,
great idea.
That'd be a great idea.
And thanks very much for calling, Rush. Appreciate it very much. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, discover what prehistoric fossils tell us about the behavior and biology of dinosaurs. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. Time for this week's topic. And Tricia, we recently heard about a new species of dinosaur that was discovered in Canada,
mm-hmm.
if I'm not mistaken. What's the word on this creature?
Well, the dino in question is called Albertoceratops nesmoi. Isn't that
Ooh.
Fun? Say that several times. Albertoceratops nesmoi. I love that.
Wow, that's a great name.
I love that name. And it's named after the region, Alberta, duh, where it was found, and Cecil Nesmo, the rancher who helped fossil hunters discover it. I love
that's
Cecil
cool.
Nesmo is now, you know, down in history forever.
And what do they know about it so far?
Well, it's fun because this species, Albertoceratops, I get a chance to say it again, is part of a well-known family. It's part of a subfamily actually known as the Centrosaurs. It lived a short 78 million years ago, a little blink of the evolutionary yeah. eye, which makes it, one of the reasons this is a big find, is the most primitive member of this particular group, of the Centrosaurs. It looks as though, based on its probably dentition, on its jaw structure, it looks like it was a plant eater. Weighed about like a half a ton pickup truck, which would mean it was weighed about, half a ton, I suppose. And like the much better known relative, the Triceratops, we all know the Triceratops, right? Every kid knows the Triceratops. This species had big, long horns over their eyes. And they had that frill, you know, that wild, spiky frill, sort of a fan-shaped
thing,
plate
yeah.
of bone that came out from its skull, was edged with spikes. It really must have been a great-looking critter.
You know, when I was in grade school, I was actually in eighth grade, I did a painting of a dinosaur. You know, in grade school, you love talking about dinosaurs and
kids
all that.
Kids love dinosaurs.
I did this painting, and our art teacher, Mr. Madsen, I found out when I graduated from college that he was still using that painting as an example of artwork.
And
You've
been memorialized.
I never felt so good in my whole life.
Aww.
But you know what? We never learned a darn thing about behavior, I don't think. When it, they like to eat.
And good reason.
And so forth.
I mean, you know what? What can you tell about behavior from bones, right?
Right.
Well, here's what's really fun is we're starting to get some really good pictures of behavior from their fossils, and particularly from not just their jaws and their dentition, the way their bodies are put together, but also their brain cases. Because it turns out the inside of their skull can tell us a lot about how their brain was designed, and that tells us a lot about how they behaved. For example, the allosaurs, this group of dinosaurs that all our kids know, the group that led eventually to birds,
alligators, right? Yeah.
Well, we know that this group was predatory because, you know, those ear canals, the vestibular canals that we all have, in mammals, it helps us keep our balance. That's also true in dinosaurs, alligators, and they can be designed differently depending on what the body has to do. And the vestibular canals of this group of dinosaurs were very similar to that of modern alligators. And it creates a system in which the body can maintain its balance if the head is shaken back and forth in one plane, but not up and down like mammals need to move their heads. So it looks like this was an animal like an alligator who grabbed its prey and then shook it, back and forth to dismember it. And it looks as though that their primary sense, which is true of a lot of animals, was chemical, is that they communicated mostly by smell. But it also looks as though, again, from their brain cases, that the connection between their olfactory centers, there wasn't a lot of cortex for it to go through. So it's not like they perceived some smell and then made these strategic decisions about what to do. It was almost a reflexive response. You know how sharks will sort of bump into something and then just bang, grab it, and then spit it out some? Hopefully, if it's you, you get spit out. Oh, that's not edible. Probably what the dinosaurs did. And the speculation is that they probably made a certain number of mistakes because they bit first and asked questions later. So it might have even been that...
So mom might have had a chunk taken out of her or something.
Yeah. You know, or out of a husband or out of her own kid or something. And lastly, it looks as though the limbic system, which is the part in the mammalian brain that mediates emotion... Mm-hmm. Not so much. Not so much.
So they didn't spend a lot of time crying over those old dinosaurs.
Probably not a big factor in their behavior.
Okay. Well, if you want to learn more about Alberta ceratops, there, I got to say it.
Hey, it's fun.
Alberta ceratops. And you want to see some pictures of the fossils, you can visit our website. We have some pictures and links to related articles at callingallpets.org. And if you have a question for us, we're ready to take some more calls right now at 1-800-462-7413. And as a matter of fact, we have some callers online. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Jenny. I'm in Boise, Idaho.
Jenny, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Thank you. Well, we have two very wonderful, goofy, orange, stripy cats. Mrs. Bunsen and Sparky.
Mrs. Bunsen.
And their mother and daughter, and they're really terrific cats, and we just adore them. But we have a real problem with them rushing the door, front door, back door, doesn't matter, whenever it opens. They really want to go outside, and they are meant to be inside cats for their own safety.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's a real problem. And I've heard you talking about training dogs to stay back when the door opens, but I just really wonder if you can train cats to not rush the door like that.
I have the perfect solution.
You do?
Yes. You rent a lion's costume. And you put it on.
I'm listening.
And then you have somebody else open the door. And when the cats come to the door, they open the door quickly. And there you are in your lion costume. And you roar at them and they'll run away.
Maybe the cats will be, oh, look. Look, it's the most beautiful, handsome male cat I've ever seen.
I like that idea, though.
Well, after you try that idea, after you try that one, here's some other Here's some other ideas for you to try.
Okay.
One is you can try a training regimen, and I'll tell you what it is briefly, but I won't spend too long because I tried it, it didn't work.
Okay.
But I have this theory that someday it will work on some cat. I actually do know one cat I work with. It's basically you teach the cat that the opening of the door is a cue to turn around and go in the other direction because in the other direction there's a piece of turkey.
Okay.
So that's one possibility. As I mentioned, I tried it for 3 months. Didn't work for me, but it did work for one cat. It's relatively easy to try. The other things to try are much more effective at higher frequencies. You have a better probability statement. And that's basically going to something mechanical. My vet clinic, for example, has a lobby cat, you know, a veterinary clinic lobby cat. Mm-hmm. But they have a front door that leads to a relatively busy road. And the cat actually wears a collar. And they have one of those electrical or mechanical devices that gives the cat a little bit of a shock.
Oh, yeah.
When it goes over the boundary. And basically what happens is the cats usually learn very, very fast, literally one or two trials. So it is aversive. It's a shock. I mean, we need to be realistic about this. It doesn't feel good. That's why it works. But
sure.
But try it on yourself. Put it on your wrist. And you decide, you know, is this too hard? If this is more than you think is fair to your cat.
Okay.
Then don't do it. Don't put it around your neck because your neck is not the equivalent of your cat's neck. I think your wrist is a better equivalent. You don't have fur on your neck, right? So that's something that if your cats are at great danger, which a lot of cats are, of going outside, then I would seriously consider that.
Okay.
Sounds like a plan to me. And if that doesn't work, go back to the lion costume.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you could come here and do that.
I will videotape it.
Yeah.
I will be there. I will videotape it, and we will put it on the website. Larry Mueller dressed in a lion costume.
I can't like
wait.
I like the vision of that, though.
I just
scare the heck out of me.
Sadist, Mueller.
Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Carrie from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a question about going on vacation. I have two dogs. One is a 6-year-old lab mutt, and one is a 1-year-old lab mutt. And we're going to be gone for about a month here in about 2 months. And I'm wanting to know, are they going to miss me? And are they going to know me when we get back?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Of course they will. Absolutely, without question. I can say that definitively. I have no concern at all that they will know you when you come back. I can't imagine that not happening. There's nothing about the biology of the brain of a dog that would prevent that from happening. And I can just tell you, experience after experience after experience of dogs who clearly recognize people, even ones they haven't seen in years. I went to New Zealand for 3.5 weeks, and there was pretty much no question when I came back. They knew who I was. So I wouldn't worry about that. Now, here's the harder one. Will they miss you? I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. And given the social nature of dogs, given the strong biology of social attachment in dogs, it makes all the sense in the world. If the object of their social attachment all of a sudden is gone, are they going to be exactly like they were before? No, you know, and I'm happy calling that missing you.
But on the other hand, if you have someone who does a great job caring for the dog, that certainly has to ease the pain, I would think.
Absolutely, yeah, and I appreciate you saying that, because when I say missing you, I don't mean that their lives are going to be destroyed for a month. Now, there are a couple of very rare cases of dogs who go into what look like deep depressions. They stop eating. They behave radically differently when somebody leaves or goes away. But that's really, really rare.
Really rare.
And one thing you might want to do if you've never gone away is go away for a night or two. You know, don't go away for a month without ever having left. You know, go away for one night and get them used to the fact that, okay, she goes away, she packs up her bags, but, you know, the next thing that happens is that she comes back. So I think what's really important is for Are the dogs going to have a house sitter? Or are they going to go to a kennel? What's going to happen to the dogs?
They're going to have a house sitter, a good friend of ours, and they both like him a bunch. He's going to come and stay with them.
Oh, that's perfect.
They have a familiar friend. Probably the most important thing is to make sure that that friend knows the dog's, the signals that you use, knows the dog's routine. So as much as he can use your same routine and use the signals that you use so he can communicate with your dogs, that's as important as everything. Go have a wonderful time.
You're going to love your
trip.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call for you to join in. Coming up next, we welcome a guest who says families are founded on conflict, and we'll find out why and learn much more about the history of families right after this. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week we welcome Scott Forbes to the program. Scott is a professor of biology at the University of Winnipeg, and he specializes in the evolutionary ecology of families. And his latest book is called A Natural History of Families. Scott, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's nice to be with you today.
You write about something you call the family myth. What is the family myth?
Well, the family myth is the idea that families are harmonious social units, that we have to get along by definition because we're family members. And so we have this romantic notion, derived from popular culture, perhaps 1950s television, about what families should be like. And when you look throughout nature, that they're not always that way.
Or the Ozzie and Harriet.
Our father knows best, yeah.
Right.
Father knows best, exactly.
Right.
But we see all sorts of examples where families are in conflict, and sometimes the conflict is very serious, and this is surprising if you believe the family myth.
Well, you know, you make the argument, for example, that parents play favorites. Do you find that that's true in all species?
It's certainly true in a lot. And again, this runs counter to our expectations about how families should work. We're all supposed to value our offspring equally. We love each and every one of our children equally. And if my children are listening, I love each of you equally. But when we take a look at things like birds and non-human mammals, we see all sorts of examples of parental favoritism where they create some offspring being bigger than others. They give some hormonal advantages. They stagger the development of the brood. And in the birds that I work on, they create hatching asynchronies. I work on red-winged blackbirds, which are perhaps the most abundant bird in North America, and they do interesting things. They hatch their offspring at different times. The ones who hatch first have a near certain chance of survival. The ones who hatch last have a equally bad chance of dying.
You write about parental optimism. What is parental optimism?
This is a widespread habit which creates a lot of the mayhem that we see in nature, and it's the habit of parents to make too many babies. And they do this for a variety of good reasons. They do it because sometimes they don't know how much food is going to be out there. So if a parent bird is laying a clutch of eggs, they may not know 2 or 3 weeks down the road how many insects are going to be flying about. So they'll add an extra egg or two to the clutch. If it's a mammal, some of the litter may be stricken by chromosomal defects, and there are some species where they use extra babies to choose the highest quality offspring, and this occurs in plants, where some plants have both self-fertilized and cross-fertilized offspring, and the cross-fertilized offspring are the more fit. And so when they have a choice between the two, they actually preferentially abort self-fertilized offspring. So this parental optimism leads to broods which initially are larger than parents want to raise and requires a later downward trimming of brood size. And so we see conflicts between parents and offspring over how much food should be delivered to the brood, whether or not certain offspring should live or die. And these are things we just don't expect within families.
So some animals have more offspring than they can handle then?
Yeah, and we see some quite dramatic examples of that. Things like pandas or tropical seabirds called boobies or black eagles or white pelicans, they do some quite sinister things. They create two eggs. They lay a two-egg clutch, but they only have the intention of raising one of them. And in many of these species, what we see is the older offspring murders its younger sibling when it hatches. And we see some just absolutely bizarre and extreme behavior. We see siblings murdering siblings. In some cases, we see parents just burying the eggs. In subantarctic penguins, we actually see mothers throwing away a viable egg. If the first egg hatches, they literally pick up their second egg and just toss it out of the nest.
Boy, you didn't see that in Happy Feet, did you?
No.
They edited that out of the penguin movie.
These are the kinds of things that don't make the front pages. The pandas are well, cute and cuddly, but if you actually take a look at their reproductive behavior, they routinely give birth to twins, and they just quietly discard one of them. If one of them turns to be viable, they simply abandon the second. And again, this is something that we don't hear about when we're talking about pandas, because it's just something that runs totally counter to our expectation of a good mother.
I'm overwhelmed with the need to watch an Ozzie and Harriet show right now.
And speaking of Ozzie and Harriet, are humans optimistic parents?
It's surprisingly true, and this is one of the curious things that I found in my research. I started looking at brood size in humans, and a lot of the interesting things occur before birth, out of sight. And one of the remarkable things that we've found in the last three decades with the advent of ultrasound technology is that twins are much more common than we ever thought. And A medical geneticist, a fellow named Charles Bocklage at East Carolina University, has suggested that, in fact, perhaps as many as 1 in 8 pregnancies start as twins. And we certainly don't end up as twins 1 in 8 times. It's about 1 in 50. And so there's a lot of prenatal brood reduction going on in humans. And one of the interesting phenomena, and I just love this kind of cross-pollination of ideas, We know that in humans, twins become more common as mothers get older. The variety of twin called dizygotic, or two-egg, becomes increasingly common after mothers get to age 35. And this appears to be an insurance mechanism against chromosomal defects. As mothers get older, their offspring are more prone to major chromosomal defects. And the really interesting thing is that this idea, which turns out to be correct, was first posited by a fellow named David Anderson, who works on the Galapagos on tropical seabirds. And he studies obligate brood reduction in birds, and he's found there that the parents lay an extra egg as insurance against the failure of one of the eggs to hatch. And he was scanning through the medical literature and saw this pattern in humans and say, you know, that's essentially the same phenomenon that I'm watching on the Galapagos, except it's occurring before birth. And so good ideas can come from just about anywhere.
We view familial cooperation as the norm, and we tend to see the benefits of cooperation. How does familial cooperation benefit a species?
Well, we have all sorts of examples where social groups can benefit one another. We have group protection in insects and birds. Birds which nest in colonies very often can nest close to one another and can help drive off predators. We have examples of extreme social groups such as Florida scrub jays, where the offspring will stick around to help raise this year's brood, so brothers and sisters will be help feeding brothers and sisters. Some of the most fascinating things I've seen are parents which work together to raise babies. I've had the fortune one time to be out watching a tidal flat where a brood of ducks was out in the open, and a pair of bald eagles showed up, a mother and father at a nest which I knew was nearby. And the two of them cooperated with one another. Well, one flew over the brood to scare them under the water. The other one had its dive timed, so as little ducklings were popping up, it would snatch them. And these two parents had absolute perfect synchrony so they could catch what would otherwise be very difficult prey to capture. So two is very much often better than one.
You mentioned that you had children, right?
Yes.
I find myself wondering, does this affect your behavior with your family?
That's a good question. It's the, you know, I don't actually think so. It's I kid my wife and my children that that I know a great deal about parent-offspring conflict. I know all the theory, and so there's no possible way my children are going to win. But it's one of these things that I think you live in sort of two minds, and you just have a private family life, and you try not to think too deeply about all the genetic conflicts which are lurking in the background.
But surely the cooperation part is heartwarming. I mean, it sounds as though I know a lot of your work focuses on conflict, and there's a lot of that out there, obviously, I think more than most people realize, but there's a lot of cooperation too. So at least you can look to that, right?
Oh no, and my older son is 12 years old. My younger son is 4, and my older son is like a third parent, and he's very protective and nurturing of his younger brother. Whenever he's threatened, he's very protective. It's heartwarming. It's the side of parenting that we want to see. And it is easy to focus on the negative side, but on the other side, you see just unbelievable examples of sibling sacrifice or parental sacrifice. I have a tradition of being a wildlife biologist, spent a lot of time in the woods, and the most terrifying circumstance I find myself in is seeing a bear cub and not knowing where the mother is, because you realize that that you're in the wrong place. If you're standing between a mother bear and her cub, that's just absolutely the wrong place to be, because she's going to be fiercely protective. And so we see all sorts of examples like that.
Let's talk about abuse and neglect then a little bit more.
Oh, that's a nice topic.
Yeah, you get to that side of
Let's
things.
Let's get back to abuse and neglect.
How common is abuse and neglect in the animal kingdom?
Again, if you look for it, you'll find it. It's widespread. We have, pandas throwing away offspring, penguins tossing eggs out of nests. When we see abuse and neglect, it's usually for a good reason. If we're looking at things like mice and lions, we'll see bizarre behavior where males will come in and kill all the offspring. And this, again, is something that we find repulsive. The female lioness will be fiercely protective of her cubs, but a new cohort of males who takes over a pride of female lions will kill all of the existing offspring to bring the females into sexual access sooner. And so there's some amazing video footage of male lions coming in and snatching up the little cubs and breaking their necks. And this is just bizarre. It's repulsive. And it's also understandable in terms of evolutionary biology. The males are not related to the offspring. And if they wait until the cub is old enough to leave on its own, they may not be able to father any of their own offspring. Male mice do exactly the same thing. These dark sides of parental care are things which I think we have to try and understand and apply the lessons of understanding to our own existence.
Well, you know, that brings up a question, is what more do you hope to understand about human families through your study of non-human animals?
Well, there's just a whole array of questions. One of the most fascinating is what goes on before birth. And there are many puzzling behaviors of human pregnancy that we didn't understand until we applied the lessons of genetic conflict to human behavior. And so when a mother has pregnancy sickness, or she has gestational diabetes, or she has what's known technically as preeclampsia or high blood pressure during pregnancy, these were puzzling behaviors for decades. And now we understand what's going on. And in fact, it's a conflict between the embryo and the mother. And the embryo is asking for more. It's asking for, when it's gestational diabetes or high blood pressure, it's asking for more food. It's hormonally manipulating the mother to either increase the sugar supply in her blood so the embryo can grow faster, or to increase the blood pressure so the embryo can gain access to more nutrients and oxygen. And this was identified as a parent-offspring conflict by the Harvard evolutionary biologist David Haig a little more than a decade ago. And it was just eye-opening that we realized, in fact, that embryos were causing all of these illnesses associated with pregnancy that we couldn't understand previously. And now it all makes perfect sense. It's embryos who are a little more greedy than mothers want. And we see this manifest as real disease in humans.
Interesting stuff, Scott. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, well, thanks for asking me.
Scott Forbes is the author of A Natural History of Families, and he joined us today from the studios of CBC Radio in Winnipeg. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Scott's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call. The number is 1-800-462-7413. And all correct guessers will have their names pooled together. And three winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Scott Forbes' book, A Natural History of Families. And in his book, Scott Forbes talks about how bald eagle parents are particularly sensitive to unfolding sibling rivalries, depending on which egg hatches first, the male or the female. Sibling rivalries can become deadly when food is scarce. And in order to prevent these rivalries from arising, which eggs do mother bald eagles purposely hatch first, the males or the females? And even if you don't know which, you've got a half 50.
You've got a 50-50 chance. Not bad odds.
And if you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413. Check out our website in about a week to find out the correct answer. We'll have it posted at callingallpets.org. And for now, we're ready to take some more calls. So let's go back to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Rosemary from Greenfield, Wisconsin, calling.
Thank you very much for calling, Rosemary. How can we help you?
Well, I'm interested in learning from your professional there what I can do with my 4-year-old cat. I adopted her from the Humane Society when she was on her second birthday.
And okay.
I've had her 2 years now, and she still absolutely refuses to jump on my lap.
Oh.
And I was wondering if you could give me any suggestions of what I could do other than try and hold her, but she won't even be held. I can't even hold her to brush her, although she brushes my legs at the bottom.
Good.
You know.
Okay.
But my grandchild, who had hoped to be a veterinarian but never pursued it, she told me to try treats.
Uh-huh.
But then that's not working either.
She's just real cautious. You know, a lot of cats are just so different, aren't they? They're just, some are so bold and pushy and demanding, and some are so shy and retiring, and some are aloof, and some are affiliative, and they're just, the whole gamut is out there, just all in one species.
Our two cats, one was one way and the other was just the opposite.
Night and day.
Yeah.
So Larry had the either end of the spectrum in one household. So here's one idea. It's certainly true that you can't force this on a cat. It just never works. So picking her up and trying to force her to be comfortable by holding her, it's very rarely successful. Here's the best thing to do is if you can get down on the ground, if you're comfortable, rather than sitting up on a couch or up on the chair, if you sit down on the ground, and the fact that she'll rub against you, that's excellent. That's really, really good. So if you get down to her level and figure out which food she likes absolutely the best, and you know they vary about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
My cat doesn't like chicken, thank you very much. I don't do chicken. I don't do turkey, but I love the cantaloupe. Now, explain that to me. I have no explanation except cats do what they want to do. They write their own books, right? So figure out what your cat absolutely adores to eat and that it's good for her. Make sure it's healthy. And then what I do is I would sit down on the floor rather than asking your cat to come up and sort of jump up. Get down at a kitty level and then start putting the food beside you, and then eventually, once your cat's really comfortable coming really close to you and taking the food, and don't resist the urge to reach out. It's so hard to keep our hands off of them, right? Resist the urge to reach out and pat. keep your hands down, and then put a little piece of food closer and closer to your leg, and then put it on your leg. And then gradually, especially if your cat learns that, no, you are not going to reach out your paws and try and pet her, she'll be much more likely to come up. And then once she's coming up on your lap, then you can raise a hand up, put it under her chin, not over her head, not over her back, kind of have it come from underneath, sort of maybe to the side, and maybe just a tiny little touch. I'm scratching my own chin right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, well, I'll scratch mine,
Larry's
too.
Larry's scratching his chin. Larry, if I could reach you, I'd scratch your chin, too, but I can't reach across the table. But just the tiniest little scratch on her chin, and then stop, and don't do any more that session. So that's the trick, is let her come to you, get yourself down, so that she can just sort of ooze her way up on top of your lap, because your lap is basically on the ground anyway. So give that a try and let us know how it works. But patience is the key here.
And thank you very much for calling. And you know what I've learned from scratching my chin?
You need a shave.
I didn't shave very well this morning. That's what I learned.
Yeah, me neither, Larry, yeah.
You don't need to shave.
No, I don't think so. I hope not.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Michael from Valdez, Alaska.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
I have a six-year-old Samoyed who lives on our sailboat with my wife and I, Susanna, and we left Portland last May. And when you sail from Portland to Alaska, you're near land almost all the time. And the problem that we came up with is that sometimes you can't take the dog to land to do her business.
Right.
Because there's bears. And more importantly, there are a couple of chunks of the trip that are 50 and 60 hours long away from land. And I know it's very bad for dogs to go for 50 or 60 hours without
sure.
doing our business.
Sure.
And this dog is a particularly intelligent dog. And she has a command for doing her business.
Okay.
And she will do it. And everyone we met, fishermen and other boaters, said, well, get a mat and put the mat down and give her a command and show her the mat and she'll do it. And there's no way.
Right.
She looks at you like you're crazy.
Right.
And then this summer, we're moving from Valdez out towards Kodiak. And I expect that there, even though we'll be closer to shore all the time, there will be more instances where, for whatever reason, mostly bears, or weather, that she can't go to shore,
right.
And I want to come up with a way to encourage her that it's okay to relieve herself on deck.
Oh, I love this call. We haven't
yeah.
had a call like this, and I love this image of
too.
You on the sailboat. Here's what you need to do. You need to figure out what is the substrate. Will she go on sand? Will she go on soil? What is it she's most comfortable going on? And
right.
then get some of it and get, is there room? Here's what I don't know because I don't sail. Basically, I want you to make a litter box. So a version of a litter box that has in it, that has whatever it is she's used to going on. And in that box, I want you to have, say it's, let's just make it up. Let's just say it's grass.
Okay.
So you've dug up some turf. And what I want you to do is dig up some turf that has the scent of her urination or defecation on it.
All right.
Because she's going to use smell. And she's going to use feel. And so if it smells like she's been there before and it feels like it's a place that her paws should be on to go, she's much more likely to go.
And we've tried that with the mat that we had, and we suspected that it might be that the grass was prickly. So we have a new mat for this coming summer that's not so prickly. And we were wondering if you had any suggestions for how we could get her to think that this is okay before we're house-sitting
yes.
now, before we could get her back on the boat.
So the mat is not working, okay?
Okay.
The last year's mat didn't work. I'm not sure why this year's mat would work either. So what I would do is what you could start doing is when you're on land, and actually my mother did this to train her dogs to go on her porch in a litter box that we had built for her little dogs when mom was elderly, moved mm-hmm. to an apartment. So what we did is when she was living in a home, is we put portable fencing, it's called an exercise pen, an X pen, you can buy it at any pet store, at the bottom of the stairs in the yard outside my mother's house. So every morning the dogs would go down the stairs and they go into the yard and they go potty, right? So every morning what that would happen is they would go down the stairs and at the bottom of the stairs was what they were used to going to the bathroom on in a box-like area, and then there was an X pen around it, basically a fence, so they couldn't
right.
go anywhere else. So what does every animal have to do first thing in the morning? They have to urinate. So they would go into this area in this context where they would normally go. They couldn't walk around like they normally did. But, yes, they all went to the bathroom there eventually. And then we basically just took the same substrate, put it into a larger litter box, basically, on my mother's balcony. So that's what you can do, is you can, when you're on land, let them outside, have a portable fence around the back door, be very conscious of what substrate they're going on, and then use that same substrate in a litter box-like area on your sailboat. You can do this. You can do this, I promise.
And good luck with the sailing.
Thank you so much.
And if you have trouble, call me, because I'd be forced to come out and hang out on a sailboat off the most beautiful coast in the world.
So we have a standing invitation. Anybody who wants to come visit, all they have to do is get to us, which can be exciting sometimes.
I lived in Alaska, so I'm aware of that. But so careful, because Larry and I might show up sometime soon.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Great set of calls, great interview.
Great listeners, don't we?
Yeah, we sure do. And thank you, Patricia. We'll look forward to next week's visit.
I'm glad we'll be back again. Makes me happy.
I sure hope so. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.